Sirenauts, and welcome to this week's Observations. I'm your host, Sovereign Sire, and I'm brought to you by the Bon Vivants and Ne'er-do-wells over at julieland.com. And as always, I'm joined by the lovely, the wonderful, the cranky, the curmudgeonly Mr. Richard Avery.
Good afternoon, sunshine.
You actually were very nice to me today. Good morning, sunshine, when I came in. It was nice.
I'm always nice.
Today I have with me Eliza Skinner.
Hi.
So today's topic is the wonder of you. I'm just going to be talking to you about you.
Me? Specifically yes, me or yes. The concept of identity?
Well, I mean, we could do like the history of the self. That actually
Myers-Briggs, all that.
Yeah. I'll leave and I'll come back when you guys are done.
Actually, no. One of my favorite documentaries is by Adam Curtis. And it's called The Century of the Self. And it's a four-part documentary. He was a big time, he was an archivist at the BBC for a really long time. So he used to sit down and like go through like all the weird photos, all the weird commercials, like just any weird thing that had ever been aired. He was a person sort of curating and organizing and managing that content, and he came out of it as a director, and his documentaries are known for the way that he's able to like weave this really interesting archival footage into the narrative thrust. Right. Mm-hmm. He did a really fascinating one called Century of the Self that basically documented the emergence of the concept of the self and self-actualization, and it's fascinating.
I think it's really fascinating that I think it's the top best-selling genre of books is self-help. Yeah. And I think they are generally completely ineffective. They just like create more demand for themselves. Like it makes people focus on what's wrong with them rather than just like figuring it out and living your life. And it doesn't actually change. There are books that are like, this is how your brain works. And
have you ever read one?
Sure.
Did you ever read Road Less Traveled?
Uh-uh.
I did a Tony Robbins seminar thing once.
Yeah. I'm very curious about
those.
And I read
Road Less Traveled. And I've only read like four books in my life. And I read...
Is everything fixed now?
No.
Not even close. That's what I mean.
No, but you know, here's my philosophy on it all. I believe that you can learn like one... Even if you get a grain of sand out of something like that, because that's what life's all about is learning anyways. My motto is if you listen, you learn. So if you... You might read a book and go like, yeah, that was really stupid and da-da-da. But if you might get one little tidbit that helps you, that's just another tool.
Yeah, but I think that a lot of them also, as I say, sort of help create this need. They make people feel like they're not well-formed enough mentally and emotionally. And so they need that advice rather than helping them, rather than like focusing on all the things that they are doing right. And that like, well, you know what, we're all different brains and different people, and we're not going to be all good at the same things, but hey, you're a super good listener, or you're a terrible listener, but like, hey, you're a super good action taker and organizer, whatever. I don't know. I mean, maybe it's too like,
I think you're right. Cause I think the best advice or the best kind of thing to teach people is getting them to overcome fear. Mm-hmm. That like I was just talking with my brother's like been going through this really weird breakup for like way too long.
And how long is way too long?
like a year.
That is
like,
way too
like
long.
Like just really like way. Hurting, like just really hurting over this breakup, and kind of maybe because of his age or where he is in his life, it just felt like very significant. But I spent a lot of time sort of being that bouncing board on the phone. And it was just today, he would call, like, as I was heading over here, we're talking, and I kind of snapped. I was like, you just need to, like, do something, you know? Like, just, like, move out of Seattle. Like, move down to L.A. and, like, try to sell a movie. Like, I don't, like, you know, just, like, take action. And momentum. I feel like your life will get better.
Yeah, I think that's true. Like, momentum. Like, you just go out and, like, live your life. Don't. You know,
what advice I would have given him, I just would have said, I would have been like, bitches, man, bitches.
I've given him that advice. Women are crazy. You're a good person. It's like, you may feel that that's how you look to other people, but that's really just something you're telling yourself. You know, like those things that you like, I know that feels true, but it's not true. Like that kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah. But like at a certain point, like with people, you just kind of. I feel like my life didn't change until I met someone that encouraged me to fly to New York to meet him, and I was going to be a model, like doing nude modeling or whatever. But it was like stepping out of my comfort zone. It was like basically when like, I'm going to take this risk. I'm going to like go to this huge city and try this thing. And it wasn't like it immediately.
How long was he together with this girl?
They'd been, oh, it was bad. They'd been friends for maybe 8 years. Okay. And then they had like decided to try.
Yeah,
to,
that can be kind of, well, my advice that can really surprise you. And yeah. Like how someone is different in a relationship yeah. versus in a friendship. Yeah. Like you think, oh, this is working, so it's going to work.
Right.
And
yeah.
people have much different
let's be friends.
Needs and let's be friends. expectations.
Did, yeah. he get, give, did he get the let's be friends speech? It's not
no,
you.
No, it was a very convoluted and sort of specific situation. But I think... what I'm coming to say is that at the end of the day, things don't really change until you change them,
right.
you know? And so mm-hmm. for me, it was going to New York and like taking that risk and going like, I'm going to go to this place I've never been. It's huge. I've never really tried to survive on my own, but I'm going to do it because if I don't, you know, life here is just going to be the same. And obviously it's not fulfilling because I want, you know, yeah.
yeah. Do massive yeah. amounts of alcohol and drugs.
Yeah. That like what everyone else does, right? Like they get loaded or
that's
they get pregnant
do.
Or yeah. like that's what people do, right?
They're
like,
don't. And then they stop doing them and that's another big change.
Yeah. yeah
so it's like, yeah. Yeah. I feel like moving out here to LA, like I'd been in New York for a long time doing comedy and then moving here, didn't, I mean, I guess it ended up changing my career, but it definitely changed me in that it felt like my family was on the East Coast mm-hmm. and, you know, being like the youngest sibling, it was always like the kid of the group. Coming out here, I was like, this is my city. This is
right.
my coast.
Right. You're making
I am
all your own
completely.
Systems.
Yeah. I'm like a for real grown up now and independent. And like, it felt really different because I'd been like living on my own and everything, but this just felt like no one is teaching me this world. I'm having to figure out this world myself. And right.
what's it
that
like being a grown up? Because I still have yet to get there.
It's great. Sometimes you shop for more than one day's worth of groceries, and yeah, it's really exciting.
no idea.
so let's to go back. So mm-hmm. you were from Virginia, you said.
Yeah.
So when did you always know you were? I always say, like, did you know you were funny? But did you always know you wanted to be a performer? Like, how did... Everyone seems to come to comedy that I've interviewed so far, like, differently. Some people, like, they were writers or they were in the school play or they just stumbled into it when they were drunk one night at college and did an open mic. Like.
And don't forget about the ones that were just plain smart asses.
Yeah.
I always loved comedy. I always... when I was a kid, it was, like, anything that was funny, I wanted to watch it or read it or see it or whatever. I didn't think of myself as a comedian. I don't know, maybe I don't know why. but I liked making funny stuff. I wanted to be a rock star when I was a little kid.
Oh, yeah.
And then then I wanted to be an actor or a director. And then I decided I wanted to be a puppeteer or a talent agent. But in college, I went to college for mass communication.
Okay.
Which is a degree in watching TV, I'm sure
yep.
you know, which I'm very good at.
Can you change the channels by yourself?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I can talk about a TV show forever. But so while I was in college, one of my housemates, I lived with five guys, and one of them was like, he was obsessed with the improv group on campus. Mm-hmm. And so he wanted to audition, but he was scared to go by himself, so he made all of us go. And out of like 200 people auditioned, this was a shitty college town, so the only thing in town was this improv group. Out of like 200 people, they cast my housemate and me. And I was like, oh, I think I might be good at this.
Wow.
And then I started, I got really into improv and I moved to New York and did improv there. And again, kind of fell into it pretty easily where mm-hmm. I took one class at a theater and then they put me in their touring company. And I was like, again, like, well, what if I put effort into this? I'm falling
right.
into it pretty
right.
easily.
Yeah, yeah.
What if I actually like tried hard? And I started really focusing on it. And I got really into musical improv, which I guess is sort of my interest in comedy plus my wanting to be a rock star
yeah.
together. And I did that for a really long time.
Was that when you, was that the hip hop thing, the freestyling thing?
That was part of it. Yeah. I did musical improv where I would improvise musicals. So very like Broadway style.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also started a freestyle rap battle for comics. So completely improvised freestyle rapping.
Which sounds amazing.
It's really
Wait a
fun.
Minute. Freestyle rapping.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
funny.
Yeah.
Oh
it's,
my God.
It's really magic. And people are always like, oh my God, how do you find comics who can freestyle? And that's not what it's about. It's
yeah.
about finding brave comics
yeah,
who are willing
say.
To try it.
Yeah.
And you drop a beat and then,
mm-hmm,
oh
yep.
my God.
Got a beatboxer,
awesome.
An amazing beatboxer, and he goes and they, the rhythm of comedy and the rhythm of hip hop are not dissimilar.
Right.
They help each other. And seeing people really on the line brings something out of them, like this mix of adrenaline and vulnerability that is mm-hmm. really engaging to watch. And they're great comics, so it's always going to be funny.
Wow. Who was the best? Like when you were doing that, who were like people that stood out where you're like, or was there anyone that was like sort of surprisingly good?
Yeah, there were
like sort of.
There have been a lot of people. There was a guy named Peter Gwynn who was a writer for the Colbert Report, uh-huh. and he would just win over and over. he rapped as PG, OPG-13. There's also a guy who rapped as Neil Rhymestrong, who was really, really funny. He was an improviser from New York.
That's amazing.
Let's see, out here, like people that, Utkarsh and Budkar is amazing at it, but that's not too super surprising. He was in Pitch Perfect. Mm. Thomas Middleditch from, do you know the show Silicon Valley?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. He's the lead in that.
Oh, that guy. Yeah, 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 yeah.
Yeah, he's won a bunch of them. He's not a good rapper, but he's so engaging. The audience loves him so much. Like one of his rhymes, one of my favorite lines of his was, "Hey, you, I like your pants. We like each other's pants. That's something." That doesn't rhyme. There's no rhyme in there at all. But the audience just loved him so much, they kept voting for him to come back.
Yeah, it's like
is this something you still do?
Yeah, the next one is this week on Tuesday, 11 o'clock.
Ooh!
I want to go see it.
Yeah, you should come.
That sounds genius, though. But now I want to go back because I like musicals. So what did you do in the musical one?
Again,
how did that work?
I would get a suggestion from the audience, and then me and I did a show for a long time with one other girl, and then I also did a show where there was like a cast of about 5 or 6 people. And either way, we would just improvise a whole musical based on that suggestion. So musicals... I mean, all storytelling kind of has that similar, right. The hero.
Because
I
grew up on musicals. Yeah. I grew up watching Guys and Dolls and Bye Bye Birdie and things like that.
Yeah. And I taught a lot of classes in musical improv. So, you know, you start out with your environment song and then you do your want song and then you do your encouraging like side character songs. You know, the whole
now
thing.
Now I'm going to sit there. I'm going to watch.
There's like a science to it.
Yeah, now I'm going to watch. I'm going to sit here. I'm going to watch Seven Brides for Seven Brothers and just like analyze
you
it
probably,
for the first time in my life. You're like, oh, there's this.
No, this is really interesting. Because I took the narrative theory class, but we didn't
see where the songs go.
Like, well, I mean, we were dealing more with like fiction, but we did branch out to other stuff. But like, that's really so. There's sort of a formula.
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
What is that formula?
I mean, and people can break that formula, especially when they're writing it. But when you're improvising, you want to keep things as simple and reliable as possible, so that then you can have fun with everything else about it. So you'd start out with an environment song.
So what does that mean?
That's about where the show is taking place, either literally the place that they, like the town that they're supposed to be in, or the tone of the show. It's like walking you into the world of the show.
So like Arabian Nights, like the beginning of Aladdin, mm-hmm. that whole song. Mm-hmm. Okay, so then what's the...
for Little Mermaid, it would be Fathoms Below, that they're like singing about like this below the sea and this era of storytelling. And in Beauty and the Beast, it's that... that's Bonjour, the bell song where she's walking through the town, this little provincial town, literally being like, this is what you will be seeing in this show. Then you have your lead character sings a want song, which is what they really want. It's what they dream of, they wish for. And that's going to be the want that pushes you through the whole story. So like with the Little Mermaid, part of your world. Okay. She wants to be part of... people's world, the human's world, and that's the whole story of the show, is her figuring out how to do that.
You guys were doing this in with comedy though.
Yeah,
that's really cool.
Yeah,
kind of gutsy.
Weren't like making fun of existing musicals, like you were like mm-mm. creating your own sort of as you were
brand new musicals. Yeah,
wow,
that's awesome.
mm-hmm. Yeah,
wow.
And people still will like sometimes come up. Not so much. It's been a little while, so not that often. But I do get messages from people, and they're like, "Remember this thing that you did, this show that you did, or this song that you did?" Yeah. And I'm like, "Nope, not at all. It's like a fever dream. Sorry." I just like go. And
I was drunk that
some
night.
Some part of my brain just takes over and does it.
So how long were you in New York?
10 years.
10 years.
Did you do stand-up?
I started doing stand-up there.
Okay.
And it was difficult because I had done improv for so long and I was so known for that when I would try to get booked on shows, they'd be like, "Are you going to bring a piano and 3 other people? Like, what are you talking about?" And I'd be like, no, I do stand-up. And I also didn't know how much stand-up I needed to do before I could do those shows. Like, mm-hmm. there's a big learning curve with stand-up.
Yeah.
And so I, like, did some open mics and was like, there we go, I'm ready. And then the stand-up community was like, no, you're not. And when I would do the little shows, the little open mics, since they knew me from improv, like, no one else knew me. I'm not a big deal. But in that world, they all knew me. And so I would do a little show, and they would bring me up to stage like, oh, wow, guys. Oh, man. Can't believe she's here. This is crazy. She's so funny and amazing and really great. And we don't even know how she found out about the show, Eliza Skinner. And I'd be like, what? Yeah. I am not good at this.
But like,
this is a weird
bar.
Were
comedians supportive, or were they just telling you weren't ready because they were just jealous?
No, they weren't jealous. Okay. I think they were like, my show has a bunch of good comics on it. You have like barely 5 minutes.
Okay.
No.
Yeah, it's like people are very protective. I was thinking about doing stand-up, and she was like, okay, so here's what you do. You're going to do 3 open mics a week for mm-hmm. about 6 months. Mm-hmm. Then when you do that, then you're going to go to like this show where it's like you're half booked on. You're booked on. Like, and it was this thing where she's like, because I want you to do well. And it's like, it's more about being like protective of the art mm-hmm. itself. Yeah. Like kind of, yeah, it's like, and then also just recognizing that like it takes... like what you're saying, it's like there's this learning curve where like,
yeah, you have to get good at it.
Yeah, like you can't, it's crazy hard.
It's especially loaded for women because if we mm-hmm. go up too early and people see us as green, not so great comics, that's an audience sees that and is like, oh, that's how funny women are.
Right.
Women aren't that funny. Whereas the men have just been doing more reps,
right?
So
well, I think it's like there's this other kind of thing, which is like if a young female comedian, not young even, it's like a female comedian that's like attractive or whatever, that like guy comedians will kind of pull her on shows before she's ready because they want to,
yeah,
you know, and then like it ends up sort of hobbling her in the end, and then I've yeah. noticed that there's a weird subculture of like how these things interact with each other.
There's a weird tension because they also, women sometimes just don't even get spots, mm-hmm. Especially in the past. It's less so now. Now there's been so much of a push to put more women on shows that it's evening out. But so there are guys who will put them on shows to be like, I'm helping women in comedy out. But yeah, there are a lot of guys who do that too because they're like, I think this girl is cute.
Right. And then she gets a reputation for not being good, but it's just she wasn't ready. And
exactly.
then she goes away and gets really good and tries to come back. And it's like, well, she wasn't funny.
Yeah.
Like,
and sometimes people are good. Also good in like, unless you are amazing, it's all in the eye of the beholder. Like it's up to whoever's, it's so subjective.
Yeah.
So someone will go up at a show, and if she's hot, there are always dudes in the back of the room who are like, she's just on this show cause she's hot.
Right.
The only reason that she got this is because she's cute,
right.
Which is totally unfair to that comic who's like, unless they're up there being like, look at how pretty I am, which I haven't seen, although it's probably out there.
There's a few. I know that
Ellen,
it's definitely
generous is like that.
Yeah.
I know that it's definitely
hi God, it's Ellen, I'm pretty. that famous bit she did.
I'm trying to think of a really like hot female comedian. I'm trying to think. Is there one?
There's
Chelsea
a bunch.
Handler's pretty hot.
All right.
Annie Lederman, Whitney Cummings,
Natasha Leggero.
There's like so many. I feel we're not mentioning people.
I feel bad.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't really watch that much. So yeah.
But well, I feel like though when they are attractive, like Liza Schlesinger or like where they're like very, like it's like they it must be addressed.
Yeah.
It has to be almost addressed in the routine. Right. Like, I know I might look slightly heteronormatively attractive, but let me go ahead and make a joke about it so that we're all comfortable with the fact that I'm like...
I mean, it doesn't always, but you just have to know how to handle it. I used to purposefully go up looking like a sack of garbage. Like, I would wear clothes that were way too big for me and like layers and layers. And it was so easy. Comedy was so easy like that. And
I was going to say, because I look at like your headshots and stuff like that, and I was like, this girl's so pretty, she's coming on the show. So I was like, how do you hide that?
Do you think it's partially because if you do go up looking pretty and feeling good, that right off the bat, before you even say anything, they're going to judge you off your looks?
Well, yeah, that's what I was going to say. So now I'm trying to look good and like be able to look like myself and like and put myself together nicely and go up. And they do judge you. And also what's really weird is this most, I think this has only happened in clubs. Dudes will try to talk to you the way that they would in a bar while you're doing your set, while you're working. And that's heckling. And they don't realize it's heckling. They're just like answering back really loudly or like trying to get your attention the same way that they do everywhere. And you have to know how to handle it and know how to shut it down and keep moving that in a way that doesn't make them so angry that then they're like, right. Why is this girl being such a bitch?
Yeah.
Why is she being such a bitch? I'm just trying to talk to her. Like, yeah. I am literally on stage working right
yeah,
now.
Exactly.
Why are you doing this?
Wow.
It's very weird because they don't know. I also feel like they don't know that they're doing it. The
they're also probably a little drunk and probably
like
not.
But do you feel like audiences
they're thinking
too,
out
just,
loud kind
yeah.
of thing?
Like yeah. audiences too just like kind of react differently to. So my friend was just doing a show in Chicago and she had a bit where she talks about like when she was in junior high, she was like really flat chested or like just joke about her body.
Mm-hmm.
And like the whole audience was like, oh
yeah, they aws. That's the
thing. And she lost her shit. She was like, I broke. Yeah. And I like snapped at the audience and she kind of went on this rant where she was like, she ended up going on this rant where it's like, any dude can come up here mm-hmm. and make a joke about his appearance and everyone laughs. And the minute a female comes up and like makes a joke about her appearance, it's like, let's all feel sorry for and sad for. Like,
yeah, it's really frustrating.
And I had never thought about that, like how it must be to kind of have to.
Well, because women's worth is tied into their appearance. Like in societally, women are, their entire worth is judged on how they look. And so if you ding your own, the way you look, you're dinging your entire worth to an audience. Whereas a guy, that's just one of the things about you.
Huh.
So if you say something like, oh, I'm such a fat sack of shit, and you're a dude, they're like, ha, but I bet he's good with cars. We don't care. But if you're a woman, they're like, oh my God, she has nothing. She has nothing.
Right.
So, so they're like, oh no, she knows. We were hoping she didn't know. Or like, don't feel that way. What's really weird is when they like, if you make jokes like that and then they'll like try to hit on you, like almost like, hey, I'll take care of you. I heard you say how gross you were and don't worry, I'll fuck you. Like, yuck, I don't like you. When I was like, guys don't like me, I didn't mean you. I meant attractive guys don't like me, not gross weirdos.
Right.
But they feel sorry for you. So
yeah, like I don't need that. I don't need that. But
do you feel like you have to like, do you adjust your material, realizing that audiences are going to react to you differently, like taking into account these things, like that kind of audiences have a very
a little bit, and because you have to be aware of what they're seeing when they look at you. So if I have like I've had jokes about having problems with dating. Is it all just having problems with dating?
Or like, oh my God.
Or like exes or whatever. And if I present that just the way that I feel inside, if they are in the audience and they're like, she's too pretty to have that problem, then I'm going to then I have to adjust it.
Right.
And explain why that's not true and you could still have that problem or whatever. Because sometimes it can even make them annoyed. You have to do a little bit of adjusting all the time.
So was it like how long did it take you? Like you saying like you started doing stand up and you didn't realize you like how long do you think it took you to kind of get through that learning curve?
To get good at stand up?
Yeah.
Well, I moved here and I got better much faster because when I got to LA, people were like, "Who are you? What do you do?"
Right.
And I was like, "I'm Eliza. I'm a stand up." And they're like, "Okay, do our stand up show then." So I was suddenly doing way more shows and I started hosting my own show here.
Right.
So I had to have a lot of material each week for that. And so, you know, I think that if I was going to put like a year on it, I would say like about like 4 years in, I was like, mm-hmm. Oh, I think I know what I'm doing.
Right.
And now I think I'm at like, well, yeah. Oh, so now I'm at like 5 years in, so maybe 3 years in, I knew what I was doing. For about 2 years, I've been just refining it, but now I'm trying to add music back into it.
Right.
And so that's my new challenge, figuring out how do I fold the music back in.
Is that a point of contention in comedy, like people
big
that do
time.
Music? Can we like, I knew the answer to that question before I asked it, but then I wanted to talk about that. Like,
well, it's part of the reason why I didn't do musical comedy is because, like, everyone was always like, this doesn't make any sense. What you do is music. You're doing stand-up now. Why aren't you doing a musical act? I wrote a solo show, put no songs in it. They were like, this is what you should be doing. But then in the same breath, they'd be like, that's a gimmick. Everyone just likes music. It's only one joke for the whole song. It's hack. It's easy. It's easier than making people laugh with just words. So I got good at making people laugh with just words. And then I realized I'm a stand-up just like everybody else. Just like every other stand-up. And I have this thing in my back pocket that, like, almost no one else does.
Right.
So why would I not use that thing?
So just so I understand, are you saying, like, you want to perform with, like, because there are comedians that perform with guitars and sing songs.
It's like looked down upon by other comics. All this.
Really?
And like Steve, I saw Steve Martin in
1978.
That. Like, I think it's really fascinating that kind of, in any creative ecosystem,
yeah, but
that they have, become these rules.
Oh, yeah.
But you know? I saw Steve Martin in 78, and he was playing with a banjo, and he played songs in the middle of his act, and he did things like that.
Well, I mean, he's seen as an icon now, so he's safe from it.
Yeah, but he...
But I bet people at the same time were like,
I don't know. I don't think
Weirdo with his banjo and his arrow.
I could see Richard Pryor probably getting
upset. Yeah, probably.
Or George Carlin. What the hell's going on
here? And that's the thing. There are these different sort of disciples and schools that kind of descend from each of those comics, and... They to get good at what you do, you have to have really strong opinions, especially when you're starting out. And they have to be like, I love this, I hate that, so I'm going to do this, and I'm never going to do that.
Right.
And people who do that are dumb. and that's that little last part is like, oh, that sucks.
That's the kind of the way I work.
I think any creative field, you have to, because you have to really become yourself.
Exactly. I say to everybody, I do what I love, and if you don't like it, fuck off.
Yeah. And so people do that with stand-up, and they having anything else, I mean... That's why prop comics, that's an easy, obvious one. We all hate prop comics. Sorry, Carrot Top.
Gallagher. Yeah. I love Gallagher.
Really?
Hey, have you heard the Mark Maron interview with Gallagher?
The first time I saw him, sure. He was hilarious.
Yeah, because he's smashing stuff.
I know.
And he's on a giant couch.
Really,
what?
We never saw that before, okay?
I know.
And you were like, that was amazing. Oh my God, did you see that? That's what I'm saying. When Steve Martin came along, you never saw that. I grew up on Richard Pryor and George Carlin. Those were my heroes when I was a kid. So all of a sudden, Steve Martin comes along and he's doing this weird balloon things, and you're like, "Oh my God, this guy's crazy!"
Yeah.
So like all that stuff. But yeah, prop comments. I can only think of Gallagher. I didn't even think of Carrot Top.
Yeah, and I think Howie Mandel was a prop comic.
Yeah.
Wasn't he?
Yeah,
he was doing stand up. It's just seen as a crutch. Whatever it is, if it's something besides your face and a microphone,
right,
it's seen as a crutch. And people do love music. They just love music. So
I've heard that.
Yeah. So adding that to it, they're going to like you. Unless you're bad at it.
Right.
If you do bad music, that's terrible.
Because I read something like that and I was like, that's weird. Because I normally like hate music and comedy. Like I hate when a stand-up like pulls out an instrument. I'm like, oh God. Unless it was like the Flying Conchords though. And then I was like, oh, I guess no, if it's the right thing, then like, yeah, I totally love it.
Well, that's the thing. I have, and so, so
right.
in my, like, I'm not going to do it. I have like, I would say at least half of the LA comedy community has had heart to hearts with me where they're like, hey, it's going to be different when you're doing it. It's not going to be gross music because you don't do gross music. And I'm like, I don't know. It's so gross. And they're like, no, it won't be gross. You're really good at it. Don't worry.
It sounds like you've had a few interventions on this whole thing.
Yeah. Well, because like, I'll do a show and I'll really put effort into the stand-up and da-da-da-da, and then somebody throws a beat on and I freestyle and the audience is like, we don't care about anything else you've said. We love it. And other comics are like, we don't have that. Dummy, do that thing that makes the audience so happy.
Right.
Yeah. And I'm like, oh, but
I agree.
I know people are going to say dumb things and I don't know. So I've been trying to figure out a way to do it that feels authentic. Right. To me and feels interesting to me and isn't, because I could go out there and do like a grown-up version of a children's show that people are like, yay, we like it, she rhymed penis and Venus and yay, like
and I think that's the thing. It's like I have a visceral reaction like against that kind of stuff, but like I think like say like what fight like what Jemaine Clement and them were doing, like there was something really kind of
specific
and special about the material they were writing that like you were like, oh, this isn't like dumb.
Yeah, it has
this,
an interesting
like
point of view.
Like actually good and like that takes some skill.
I know this sounds really crazy, but you have me like thinking about comedians and music right now. And I'm thinking about like the greats, like Smothers Brothers were genius at it. You know,
but it was also like that stuff is of a different era. So like yeah. once something gets worn, once that happens, then other people are like, or who come after them are seen as like, ugh, you're just doing that Smothers
yeah,
Brothers
Yeah, but it's
thing.
Been a long time, so.
Yeah.
And most people under 40 don't know who the Smothers Brothers
are. Well, and it's also, you know, it's a little different for women. Women, comedians, traditionally were music acts. Yeah. And so I was like, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to like be a, I don't need to pepper my set with songs to make people like me. I'm going to just do words. Also, though, a lot of times women like that just get seen as musicians, not even comedians. Like Bette Midler is sort of interesting in that she's seen as a musician and an actor and not really seen as a comic. Like no one would put her on a list of comedians, but isn't that what she was doing?
Can right. I tell you, yeah, what you know what I think of her as? If I had to put a word on and a label on her, which I don't like doing, but if I had to, I think of her as an entertainer.
Yeah.
Just like I would think my hero was Sammy Davis Jr. when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And I always said he was the best entertainer. An yeah. entertainer.
Yeah.
And he could do it all. Mm-hmm. And those are entertainers to me. Those are the ones that can, doesn't matter what they're put
they're
in front
doing
of them.
Everything.
Yeah, they yeah. can do it all. And it's not a bad thing.
No, but it is. It's hard to monetize.
Yeah.
Oh. I think it's kind of like the
whole
best,
another podcast show.
The best part of the How creative to make process, money. Though, is like when you're challenging yourself in that way, when mm-hmm. you're going, there's a thing I can do. Like I just did a history show thing. Hmm. And it was like, because I'm a writer and I went to college and graduate school for that before I ever did adult. And I was constant. And it was like, but it was this thing of like, like, how do you market that as a brand? Like, how do you put that into, like, a cerebral this or that? And it was, like, doing that show for YouTube, or what it was for a channel called Wisecrack. It was, like, edutainment. But there was mm-hmm. something about, like, writing those episodes and doing it that was, like, the challenge of, like, how do you, like, incorporate, like, this sort of very, these, like, very disparate, like, bring in this skill.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I get it, like, in terms of, like, it's, like, trying to figure out like how to solve that problem, like yeah. going like there's these disparate things that like I want to pull together and make like good, like not a gimmick. Mm-hmm. Cause the thing with like doing this history show was like, is it a gimmick that you do porn? Like sort of figuring out how to do it in a way where it's like, you're kind of acknowledging one, but like you're, it's not like a gimmick.
Yeah. Or it's a gimmick that is well worth it.
Yes,
and like
yes,
paid
yes.
off more than people might've expected it.
Right.
To.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Like sure. Fine. Yeah, it's porny history, but we're going to surprise you and challenge you right. and like, yeah.
Yeah. It was very satisfying to like come up with those scripts and have them be good and then get the reviews and the like to get the positive thing of like, oh, this is actually like to get reviews that were like, this is going to sound funny, but like actually it's really good. Like that was like, it was very satisfying cause, and it took like 3 months to figure out how to like do it in a way that was like,
are you going
to
do more?
We have 4 in the can so far, so we're going to see like how they fare. But the first 2 that went up did very, very well. We've got like 70,000 views in a couple days.
That's great.
Yeah. Like, so
do you have a YouTube channel or?
I do. Cause
like everybody does.
Yeah. Eliza Skinner.
And you have your own podcast show?
I don't. I should.
Like everybody does.
I should, but I don't yet.
I'll do it for you then.
Okay.
I want to I just want to like every comedian we've had here, especially, I hate to say it. We're only listening, but it's the girls. I love the girls.
Well, you guys had Janine Brito
yeah,
on.
I love her.
She,
like, I'm her biggest fan. But like, every girl you've had here saw, like, every one of them, I was like, man, they'd be fun to do shows with.
yeah.
I should create the all-girl comedian network.
Janine and I don't know if she told you, I wanted to do a podcast with her where I explained dicks to her. Because her ideas about them are always so incorrect. Like the picture she would have, like we would sit around when we were working together, she would like say something and we'd be like, wait, what do you think? And she'd be like, no, they're shaped like this and they do this, right? And we're like, no, what are you talking about? And then I would,
oh God, I love Janine.
I know. And then I would be like, okay, this is what actually happens. And then and she would be like, what? No, that's disgusting.
Oh my God. I wonder
how like balls like move of their own accord.
I mean,
did you even get that far?
No.
I feel like that would really disturb her.
The big watershed one was she had no idea that like a dude could have a boner that like points up and then gets tucked under his waistband. Is this too gross? Sorry.
No.
And like she like thought they were always like straight out in front. And so I was like, yeah, no, they're not straight out in front. They're like, and they kind of like, they can be the side. Like sometimes they'll like, you know, if that's during the day, that's like in the waistband. And she was like, I could have been hugged by a man with a boner and not know it. I'm like, well, you probably would know it. But yes, you could definitely be hugged by a man with a boner.
Sob, get her back here. We have to have a little intervention for her. Oh, we have to get like an intervention, have one of the male porn stars come over here and
no, that would be too much. Because then she'd have a totally different idea about what was going on.
Like,
it's like, get her a pro over here.
Then she'll think everyone's walking around like Manuel Ferrara.
Exactly. They're not like, this is one of a kind here.
Yeah.
This is made of diamonds.
This is a high end. What you want is a starter.
The beginner model.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
So with that, let's take a break, kind of wrap up this one,
and get ready to do another one.
Yeah. We're going to do another one?
Okay, what?
Really break it up.
All right, break it up cool.
So it's digestible. But let me, should I wind it down?
Yeah.
So why don't you tell people like where they can find you, stalk you, see where your shows are, all that kind of good stuff.
On Twitter, I'm at Eliza Skinner. My website is elizaskinner.com, but I'm really bad about updating it. And on Instagram, I'm eSkins with a Z. That's all stuff that you can
find about me. When you're doing shows and stuff, do you have like a Tumblr or YouTube or something where you kind of keep that updated?
No, I'm bad at that. I do have most of my shows. I have all my shows on Twitter.
Okay.
And I try to update my website at elizaskinner.com with my show dates.
Okay. And you guys know where to find me. I'm at Sovereign Sire on Twitter, and ilovesov.com is my website, which is probably how you're listening to this podcast. And I will see you guys next time.